I used to dream poetry in my sleep. Sometimes I would get lines that seemed to be a little better than I could get when I was awake. One time, about 10 days before Easter, an editor who had been giving me a good deal of publicity, he was editor of a newspaper, and I didn't write for newspapers, but he was giving me a great deal of publicity, and he thought a great deal of my work. And he wired me about 10 days before Easter, asking me for a poem on Easter. He wanted to put it in a box on his front page of his Sunday edition. I told my wife, he didn't understand. I said, I have no poems on Easter in my system, and I'm working on the Song of the Indian Wars. I don't want to quit. And I said, I have no thoughts whatever. And she said, oh, wait until morning. Don't wire him tonight. Maybe something will happen. He offered me $50 for four lines, eight lines, or 12, whatever I wanted to write. Well, that was money in those days. And you could buy a good many groceries with it. But I went to bed and did as I always did, repeated the lines I had been working on that day, because I realized that if I did that as I fell asleep, my subconscious mind would carry on. It would go on and on and on and on, and probably do something good in the night. Maybe it wouldn't. It might make something just foolish, but sometimes it would make something good. So I repeated the lines I'd been working on in the Song of the Indian Wars, and I dreamed, but I didn't dream about the Song of the Indian Wars. I dreamed I was in a dark room. It was black. I could see nothing, but it was full of voices. And the voices were the voices of men. And those men were real poets. I knew, because my business was criticism, and when I heard a good poet, I knew he was good. These fellows were good. But the trouble was, no one would let anyone finish his poem. They would interrupt each other. And I'd get only fragments of lines and rhymes and feelings and pictures. Little flashes of pictures. And I got up in the morning and I went and told my wife about it. I felt tired as though I'd been working all night. And I told my wife, and she said, can't you put those pieces together? I said, no, they're not related. It's all like colored rags in a rag bag. They don't belong together. And I said, anyway, I'm working on the Song of the Indian Wars. And I went into my study as usual, and as my custom was, I began by reading 100 lines back to get a running start again, 100 lines back, so that they would knit in together and all flow like a stream. And I pulled my 100 lines back and began to read them. I didn't know what I was reading. It just sounded like nonsense. And I'd push it back and pull another 100 lines out and read. Didn't seem to mean anything. I'd feel those pieces trying to come together back in my head someplace. Pieces that I dreamed trying to come together, and they weren't making sense. And I got up and I went out to the breakfast and I told my wife about it. And she said, can't you put those pieces together? And I said I didn't think I could, and I went back into my study and tried to make some sense out of the 100 lines. There was no sense. Finally, I just pushed those lines back and began to put in those pieces together. And they clung pretty well and got so they just fell into place. And I went out and read it to my wife, some of my best poems. It wasn't more than 15 or 20 minutes till I had it finished. Once more, the northbound wonder brings back the goose and crane. Prophetic sons of thunder, apostles of the rain. In many a battling river, the broken gorges boom. Behold, the mighty giver emerges from the tomb. Now robins chant the story of how the wintry sward is litten with the glory of the angel of the Lord. His countenance is lightning, and still his robe is snow, as when the dawn was brightening 2,000 years ago. Oh, who can be a stranger to what has come to pass? The pity of the manger is mighty in the grass. Undaunted by December, the sap is faithful yet. The giving earth remembers, and only men forget. It's a good little poem. You look into it more, the idea that the Christ spirit is inherent in the cosmos, that it's a cosmic thing. And it has nothing to do with whether you're a Baptist or a Methodist or a Catholic or a Protestant. It's true in all those churches. It is really based on the conception of a cosmic Christ spirit that returns into the world after a long, hard winter. I once, when I was reciting this at a church, to a picked group of students and to a young minister, I made the remark that I thought the Christ spirit was inherent in the cosmos. It wasn't something that happened 2,000 years ago and never again, that it's in the cosmos. And he said to me, the preacher, young preacher, said, what makes you say that? He was pretty modern, you know, and sophisticated. What makes you say that? I said, well, in spite of all the cruelties, I think it's true, the cruelties that you see in the world and the brutalities, it's here. And he said, well, what makes you think so? And I said, well, there are a good many things, but one thing is this. Take a little animal before it learns fear, a little animal, anything that lives, before it learns fear, be kind to it. Pet it, tell it what a lovely little thing it is so that it'll feel that you love it. And it will overflow with love. Where do you think that comes from? From the canned food that you gave it? It's inherent, and it can be brought out or driven back. You know, I have good luck with churches. I have good luck. They don't object to me. Catholics don't object to me. They're good friends of mine. Here recently, we went to visit the daughter of my old pal, John. She's a nun. And the Mother Superior was a beautiful woman, beautiful. And I had a talk with her, and I found she knew all my work. I asked her which she liked best. She said, the Song of the Indian Wars. I said, lady, if you weren't a nun, I'd kiss you. She said, we'll leave that for heaven. Think that a nun, you know, would like the Song of the Indian Wars most. Of course, it's the pity in it. It's the pity of, the theme is the pity of it all and the glory of men, both sides, courageous, you know. Neither right and neither wrong, but mistaken. Oh, who can be a stranger to what has come to pass? This is it, the pity of the manger is mighty in the grass. Somebody asked me, what do you mean by that? This managing editor saw me on the street. He said, that was a good poem. Evidently people liked it. He said, but there's a line in it that's too highbrow for me. Goes over my head. He sat and I said, well, which is the offending line? He said, you say the pity of the manger is mighty in the grass. Now, what do you mean? I said, well, I'll tell you. I never explained my poetry. But I'll tell you how you can get that line explained to you. You go out on the high plains of Wyoming early in the springtime when the snow is beginning to wither around the edges of the drifts, and at the edges of the drifts some bunches of green grass are coming on, and for each bunch of green grass there are two starved cows. Take one of those starved cows aside, read the line to her, and she will explain. The pity of the manger is mighty in the grass. The pity of Christ is in that grass. The pity of the manger is mighty in the grass. I said, she'll tell you. Oh, seek me not within a tomb. You shall not find me in the clay. I pierce a little wall of gloom to mingle with the day. I brothered with the things that pass, poor giddy joy and puckered grief. I go to brother with the grass and with the sunning leaf. Not death can sheathe me in a shroud, a joy sword whetted keen with pain. I join the armies of the cloud, the lightning and the rain. Oh, subtle in the sap a thrill, athletic in the glad uplift, a portion of the cosmic will, I pierce the planet drift. My God and I shall interknit as rain and ocean, breath and air. And oh, the very thought of it is prayer. That's my contribution to death. My bow to death. See, I've done that at a couple of funerals. They asked me to come recite that at a funeral. They're the people there, they're all feeling, you know, that everything had ended, you know, and they get the cosmic feeling, you know, that they belong to something immense. They belong, you know, they're not strangers. And also I've given poetry at weddings. I've helped them get married and I've helped them get married. When I have finished with this episode, left the hard uphill road and gone weird ways to seek another load, oh friend, regret me not, nor weep for me, child of infinity, nor dig a grave, nor rear for me a tomb to say with lying writ, here in the gloom, he who loved bigness takes a narrow room, content to pillow here his weary head, for he is dead. But give my body to the funeral pyre, and bid the laughing fire, eager and strong and swift as my desire, scatter my subtle essence into space, free me of time and place. Sweep up the bitter ashes from the hearth, fling back the dust I borrowed from the earth onto the chemic broil of death and birth, the vast alembic of the cryptic scheme, warm with the master dream. And thus, O little house that sheltered me, dissolve again in wind and rain, to be part of the cosmic weird economy. And oh, how oft with new life shalt thou lift out of the atom drift. There's a kind of a glory in the second, you know. It isn't just being burned up, it's something glorious. You go out to join the universal, you know, and you belong to it, and it's great. It's great stuff. Yeah, lots of people are going to thank me in the last days. I've had people tell me already that I helped them. Great audiences have done it. And I notice how they lean and take it because they're scared. It's a scary thing to think that you'll never be alive again. But it isn't so. Your body won't. That'll have to be scattered, and that's a portion of the cosmic will. I pierce the planet drift. My God and I shall interknit as rain and ocean, breath and air. And oh, the very thought of it is prayer. My view has become objective. And some things that have come through me are good, and I know they're good because I'm a critic. There's a humility about that that many people wouldn't understand, but most people that know me do. I have a feeling when I do something good, by God, I'm afraid something helped me to do that. It's the supreme humility because, as Dr. House in his study of me, Neihardt, Man and Poet, quote one of my letters and saying, I'll tell you, doctor, something helps. And I can see him stroking his Van Dyke and saying, yes, yes, John, something helps, something helps. That is, your subconscious does it. But when you do too well, if you say to him, really believe that you're that good, you're going to lose the power to do it. I'm superstitious about it. They say, well, what do you think helps? Well, I tell them I don't know. But I know that I can't sit down and just do it. I try and I can't do it. Something's got to happen to me first. And that's what I mean. And that isn't claiming superiority at all. It's quite the opposite. It's saying if it is, it's a pious attitude. It's a pious attitude far ahead of the ordinary notion of piety. Yes, it's a higher plane. All noble acts, all fine deeds, all beautiful art comes from there. Yes, you know it's bigger and you better know it because you're not going to continue to get it if you think you're that big. And that feeling gets across to an audience too. They know you're not showing off. They know you're not. Audiences are wonderful. They're wonderful. You get one on your side and boy, you've got an experience on your hands. Good one. I love them. I think that's the beginning of the secret. Just love them. Just love the hell out of them. They're beautiful to me.